From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, when the old Army patrolled the Texas border.
So they were given the mission, go to the border, support the law enforcement efforts to either prevent banditry or prevent arms smuggling or prevent organizations from crossing the border.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Today's newspaper headlines tells us about an increased U.S. military presence along the Texas-Mexico border. Those press reports mirror those from a century ago. Between 1911 and 1921, 10 cavalry units, 4 National Guard units, and 4 infantry units rotated through 40 different outposts guarding the border that the United States shares with Mexico. Mexico at the time was in revolution, and the West was still a wild place. Today, many may argue the increased placement of American military forces on the border is a political action that is more about optics and talking points than national security. But 100 years ago, the border's frontier concerns were legitimate. It took men on horseback with pack mules to deal with it. Thomas T. Ty Smith uncovered new information about this from Army source documents about the era that's been largely overlooked by military historians. His book is The Old Army in the Big Bend of Texas, The Last Cavalry Frontier, 1911 to 1921.
The thing that's so different about this period, 1911 and 1921, during the Mexican Revolution, that I think is important to the Army story, is that after the Spanish-American War, the Army leadership made a determination to consolidate the units of the Army into 5 brigade posts, San Antonio being one of them. The Army had been scattered really since the antebellum era and right after the Civil War into these one post, one company, penny packet post of 100 soldiers all throughout the West. In fact, at one point we had 147 little posts. What Army leadership envisioned was consolidating the units into 5 big posts, regimental and brigade size. To do this, of course, took an enormous building program from really 1903-4 into about 1910. Because they just didn't have the barracks, they didn't have the companies. So they finally were beginning to accomplish it in 1910. So at last they can consolidate the Army into large-scale units. This was important because of when you have larger units, your training is better, your health is better, instead of scattering them into little 100-man groups. Well, and they had just almost accomplished this. In fact, the building program at Fort Sam was just about completed, which was going to let the departmental commander close Fort Brown, close Fort Clark, close Fort McIntosh, and all this. Well, suddenly, of course, Madero Revolution against Porfirio Diaz occurs 1910-1911. Diaz is overthrown, and then there's a period of unease and kind of some banditry, but then cross-border operations, particularly concerning the organization of Mexican rebels on the American side. This was the violation of the Neutrality Act. So law enforcement and the congressmen, the local representatives, the city fathers, all requested the Army's help. And the mission was not for the Army to arrest these people, but to support the law enforcement effort. See, the Army, because of Posse Comitatus, the Army had no powers of arrest. But, so they were given the mission, go to the border, support the law enforcement efforts to either prevent banditry or prevent arms smuggling or prevent organizations from crossing the border. So here's Colonel Jonathan Doors commanding Fort Sam. He's about to consolidate all the units. The next thing he knows, all of his units are scattered from Douglas, Arizona to Brownsville, Texas. 36 outposts originally, and so the Army grand plan went awry in 1911. January 1911 is when the deployment happened. They thought it would only be for 6 months, maybe. Well, it turned out it was for a decade, 10 years. It wasn't until 1921 that we managed to pull in the rest of the outpost. the book that I did just focuses on the Big Bend itself, not the whole border, because that's a whole grand story in itself. And so that's kind of where we were. The Army's grand plan went awry. Law enforcement wanted support. Troops are deployed, beginning to deploy in January of 1911 to support law enforcement. That was the original concept.
We had the American Indian War. We waged war on tribes across the United States. And then we have the need for the Army to try to figure out what are we going to be now that that has basically been settled. There's no real awareness of what the role of the Army is going to be in the future, if this is just going to be a reserve force. There was no awareness that the United States would play a major international role in the world. And then we had this need to secure our border with what was happening in Mexico. Is that a good narrative?
That's a pretty good narrative. There's a little bit, a little bit of nuance to it.
Okay, let's hear it.
The Army, of course, American military policy is you keep a small standing army, and you then, in a time of crisis, the volunteers and the citizens rush to the colors, fulfill the, you know, grow the force, fight the conflict. Then they go back to civilian life, and then you have a small, again, a small army again. This has always been our until World War II, this was our basic policy. And this was in effect during this period. So, but the other piece of it was the Army had been regaled to this frontier constabulary mission, frontier police force, if you will, all through from 1848 through the Indian Wars to the end of the Indian Wars, really to stop for two major conflicts, the Civil War and then the Spanish-American War. And the Army never always resisted this frontier constabulary mission. They wanted to prepare for linear conventional conflict because that ultimately could be the threat. The Indians were never going to capture Washington, D.C. You see what I mean? What the British did in 1812. So there was always a tension between what the Army's missions got handed to them by the political spectrum and what they really wanted to prepare for. And this is somewhat similar to 1910-11 when we deployed to the border, to the Big Bend again.
But then there's also going to the Philippines.
Well, I was going to mention that. So instead of then a frontier constabulary in 1910 and 1908 and all that, we're now a global constabulary. We've got one quarter of the Army is deployed overseas. Philippines, Cuba, Puerto Rico, Alaska, Hawaii, you name it. We've got a bunch of territories that we're now having to protect. They're in China, for goodness sakes. So a quarter of the Army is actually deployed overseas during this period. So we never got away from the national constabulary mission. Well, we kind of did by 1900 into 1910.
So this is Roosevelt, Taft, Wilson.
It's Taft in 1910-11. But anyway, so we've gotten away from that mission. We're about to consolidate the Army, but now we've become an international police force in these colonies as well. So we never really quite got away from it. And then with the deployments in 1911 back to the border, again, we become a frontier constabulary. Same sort of thing. So there's always an odds between what the Army leadership really envisioned for the force and what the missions they actually had to do.
But in San Antonio, we had Fort Sam Houston. This is the lead post for the border action. When General Funston is the lead general for this action.
Frederick Funston, he's the department commander.
And he really tried to bring some order and a direction to what was going on.
He did, and his predecessor, Tasker Bliss, did the same thing. They were pretty well organized for the mission. I mean, especially most of the NCOs had already had been in for 20 years had had a little bit of experience in this. Not in the Big Bend, and we hadn't been in the Big Bend since 1893 when we left Presidio, and 1895 when Fort Hancock closed. It had been 2 decades. There weren't even any maps. They didn't even have any accurate maps.
I mean, was there much population out there?
No. Whole of the Big Bend was about 11,000 square miles, had a total population of about 5,000. There were, of course, a few small, Marfa was kind of the biggest town, then Presidio on the river, and then you had your little places like Marathon. These were all what they call tank towns. Southern Pacific Railroad and Galveston Harrisburg Railroad, they had to make stops. The trains did. So where these water tanks went in to fill the trains, a lot of times a town would grow up around it. And so these were little tank towns along the railroad. Presidio was a port of entry into Mexico. It was the only one out there that was a major port of entry. It was an important town right on the river. It was at what they call La Junta del Rios, where the Concho River intersects the Rio Grande. La Junta is what the locals call it, the junction, the meeting.
So let's talk about the men in the ranks. Who were these fellows?
By 1910, 1911, the army was about 20% foreign-born compared to the frontier army before it, which was about 50% foreign-born, most of them Irish or German. So by 1911, you had most of the soldiers were native-born. They came from working class, by and large. But, you know, you had a scattering of college-educated, you had a scattering of white-collar, and then about some 20% were foreign-born with, oddly enough, now Irish were still important, Germans, but the Russians also were important. Most of them just hard-working, middle-class, and lower working-class kids. I'd give you a perfect example of one of them. So Trooper Albert Gresky, he's one of my favorite characters that I researched. He's in Delta Troop 2nd Cavalry at Fort Bliss. Gresky grew up in New York City. He was of European descent, but he was second or third generation. European descent. He joined the 2nd Cavalry in 1910, and he deployed to the Philippines for the second Cavalry's tour of the Philippines. So by 1912, he's a tough young veteran private. You know, he's been through the mill. He's been on a tour in the Philippines. That was tough business.
That was tough fighting.
Yeah, it was. So he's at Fort Bliss. He's out in the stable out there shoveling horse poop. And then at the first sergeant's front door up shows this lawyer in a suit and tie from New York City. He's looking for Private Albert Gresky. Well, and the first sergeant says, well, what do you want with my private? You know, first sergeant's very protective. And the lawyer explains there's been a death in the family, and he's here to inform Private Gresky. So they take him back to the stable back there, and the lawyer introduces himself and says, your family sent me out here, and I want to tell you that your Uncle Jacob had died. And he says, oh, dear, you know, because Uncle Jacob was one of his favorite relatives, and he said he was real sorry about that. And the lawyer said, well, your uncle, actually it's Jacob Rothschild, has died in England, and he's left you his estate. And the family wants you to come home, and they want you to pay the... He was almost done with his enlistment. He had 1 year left on his enlistment. He could pay $90 and get out of his enlistment. And Gresky puts down his shovel, and he looks at the lawyer and says, you tell him, I ain't no quitter, and I ain't going to quit. And he turned around and went back to his business. And he deployed to Fort Hancock, and 10 months later, he got his discharge, and character marked excellent, you know. These are the kind of soldiers that we're talking about here. He wouldn't quit.
And he was not the exception. He was the rule.
Well, you still had your miscreants, but your desertion rate in, let's say, 1855, your desertion rate's about 30% in the Army. Enlist, desert. Get the bonus, enlist, desert. It gets down to, it's still about 25% after the Civil War in the Frontier Army there. By 1910, the desertion rate is about 3%, which that's pretty remarkable when you think about the different changes. And in fact, the black regiments had lower desertion rate than that. So we still had the 25th Infantry, 24th Infantry, 9th and 10th Cav. Those were all African-American regiments. They had very low enlistment rate. But why was that? Well, the Army had made efforts to improve the diet, improve the ration. Pay went up $3 from 1870. So from $13 to $17 a month, still pretty low, much lower than Landis. But they also started a period of education. Soldiers couldn't read and write. They teach them the post schools. They put soldiers in school instead of sending them out to shovel a horse poop. So they had a whole series of programs trying to improve the quality of life of the soldier. And I think that paid off in the low desertion rate. They treated them like human beings, basically.
This is Texas Matters. I'm David Martin Davies. I'm speaking with military historian Thomas T. Ty Smith about his book, The Old Army in the Big Bend of Texas.
What kind of fighting action would they have seen actually on the border?
Okay. Most of the time there, until the 8th Cavalry got there in 1970, early on from 1911 to about 1916, most of it was, you know, kind of routine firing back and forth across the border at each other. They never knew whether the Mexican federal soldiers were shooting at them or whether these were rebels or what.
Or bandits.
They interchanged quite regularly on the other side of the river, depending on who, you know, which president was in power and all that.
And that could change week by week.
Change overnight. But most of it was like minor cattle thievery. There were no really serious raids until 1916. That's when it got really tough. Between 1916 and 1918, there was a lot of very serious violence. It's in the Big Bend. In the southern border around Brownsville and Laredo, intensity of the violence was greater than it was in the Big Bend up until the 1916 period. And that's when, of course, Pancho Villa raided Columbus, Georgia in 1916.
That's when Black Jack Pershing took troops into Mexico?
He took 10 regiments into Mexico. There's a little story associated with that Columbus raid that a lot of people don't realize. In October of 1915, you're in a situation where Carranza, the former governor of Coahuila, he's now president of Mexico. He's going to be recognized by the Wilson administration. And he has two main opponents in Mexico that were former allies. In the south is Emiliano Zapata. In the north is Francisco Pancho Villa. Zapata and Villa had fallen out with Carranza over land reform. Carranza, when they supported him to come into power, he had promised to conduct land reform. He didn't. So they continued fighting, with especially Villa in the north leading the effort. So in October of 1915, Villa is getting ready to attack with his Division del Norte, Agua Prieta, Mexico, which is right across the border from Douglas, Arizona. In fact, the two towns butt right up to each other. And there was a little garrison at Agua Prieta. They were dug in. They had trench works. They had machine guns. They had barbed wire. Don't forget, this is 1915. Look at the Western Front in France. And there's already trench warfare there. Well, it's the same thing, especially with the German advisors that the Mexican army had. Yeah. So what happens is Carranza asks Wilson, hey, I got this problem at Agua Prieta. Do you mind if I take the Division del Norte, 5,000 Mexican troops, put them on a train at Eagle Pass, Texas, four trains actually, take them across Texas through El Paso, to Douglas, Arizona, and then let them cross the border to reinforce Agua Prieta. Wilson administration agrees to this, and they do this, right?
Can you imagine? So this was basically American got involved in the
in
the Civil War in Mexico. And
that was Villa's view of it. See, to this point, Villa actually had some support in the United States, and the government was they tried to be as neutral as possible, but once Villa opposed Carranza, we did two things. One, we put an arms embargo against him. Couldn't buy arms anymore. And two, we moved an entire dang division of Mexican regulars through Texas and Arizona and New Mexico and Arizona into Douglas, and they reinforced Agua Prieta. Well, Villa's attack there destroyed his division. He wouldn't quit attacking those machine guns, and he got his clap clean, basically. And he blamed the United States for this. For one, the arms embargo, and two, violating the neutrality portion of it. And he said this. He explained this, and he said, and because you've betrayed me, this is in the El Paso Herald in December the 1st, 1915, 4 months before Columbus. He said, I'm going to attack the United States. I'm going to make you pay. It's front page news in the El Paso Herald. We ignored it. Frederick Funston reported it to the departmental commander, reported it to D.C. But he said his report was kind of like, Villa would be crazy to do that. I don't believe it's going to happen. You know, well, 4 months later, Villa forces, no proof that Villa was even there, but his forces certainly attacked Columbus. It was American deaths, both civilians and soldiers and all that. So that led to the escalation of American involvement. Pershing sets out, he takes 10 regiments into Mexico. Well, ultimately, this leaves the water forces short. So the first thing that happened in May of 1916, the president calls up Texas National Guard, New Mexico National Guard, and the Arizona National Guard. They got called up in May, and they went to the border. And the 4th Texas Infantry went to the Big Bend, along with, eventually in July, the 1st Squadron of Texas Cavalry. And then in June, the next month, the president calls up the rest of the National Guard, except about 100,000 troops. And they go to the border, and they're from Brownsville, Texas, to San Diego, so the whole border. And that lasted almost a year.
Well, they brought in troops from across the country.
All kinds of states.
And they marched right through downtown San Antonio.
A lot of them did, yeah. Fort Sam was one of the big mobilization camps. And so these guys were on the border for a year. Now, not all of them went to the border. Some of them were kind of back, like in Corpus and all that, as reserves. But one thing, the Army, this consolidation thing I didn't mention, but the reason we could consolidate large forces is because we had the railroads to move them around. So you could have a large group of soldiers at a fort, and if you needed somebody, you could get them on. You could get to Marfa in a day, full day, if the trains hurried. So that idea gave us some mobility we never had before. In fact, Sherman said it revolutionized military in the United States.
There was a lot of activity along the U.S.-Mexico border with the military that prepared it for entering World War I. The first aviation observation flights happened along the border, getting troops ready for action.
Right. Well, there were two or three events that began to prepare us for mobilizing, you know, millions of men for World War I, and they almost all involved Texas. The first was in 1906. Did a practice mob of a division, and they tried to get 19,000 troops into San Antonio, and they eventually got 12,000. But the Army had not moved large-scale forces since the Spanish-American War, so it had been a long time, and there wasn't a lot of experience. So it exposed communications issues, transportation, organizational issues, and then in 1911. In 14, they did it again. Same lessons. We got to do train tables. We got to figure out all this logistics. And then, of course, when the National Guard mobilized, that was a huge effort because the Guard had no training in this, although the Army staff was responsible for moving them. So these kind of three big muscle groups were what helped us prepare for the mobilization and the war.
General Funston was going to be a Wilson's man to bring America into World War I, which was already raging in Europe. But he died.
He died at the St. Anthony Hotel. Yeah, he had an article.
He died like the day before.
No. Pershing then got stuck with the job.
Yeah, and Pershing was out in camp right at that time.
Yeah. Don't forget, Pershing had just spent the year trying to keep an entire huge force alive in a very immature theater in Mexico. So he had learned a lot of lessons about it. But this whole thing is about logistics. It's getting the soldier with his rifle to where you need him. That's the hard part.
In fighting shape.
At the general level, at the senior officer level, that's really the difficulty, is logistics. In trying to do this. And so Pershing had a lot of experience in this, especially in Mexico, because he had to feed those guys while they were down there. He had to move them around. He had to get ammunition for them. He had to do all those things. So generalship is about 90% logistics. It really is.
When we talk about the veterans that we want to remember who have fought and died for our country, and frequently we think about the grand theaters of war, and we don't always remember the men who put on the uniform. That thing always looks so uncomfortable when I see these things. And they're in the West Texas desert on horseback.
In wool uniforms. Although by now they'd started adapting khaki, but you're right. It wasn't comfortable.
We have to remember these men also as those who served.
Well, to me, I mean, anybody that puts on a uniform and makes a sacrifice, whether they deploy or not, but they got to go through the training, they give up, basically they give up their personal life for the nation. I mean, they all deserve, to me, they all deserve our honor and our support. So I don't care if you were in Iraq or you were in the Philippines or you were on the Texas border or whatever. To me, a veteran's a veteran. It's just pretty cut and dried. It's pretty simple to me.
I say men because at the time it was gender absolute. You were men who were in the Army, right?
Well, in the Big Ben, at least, there were, of course, some women there. There was Red Cross was there. The YMCA was there. Those women came out there and ran camps. The ladies of Marfa, the ladies of Alpine, organized. When these National Guardsmen went to the Big Ben, some of them brought their wives and their families with them. Wasn't authorized, they didn't get paid for it. So particularly in Alpine and in Marfa, the ladies organized themselves to help support these young wives so they could make it through this period. So women made a contribution to this.
And what do you want people to know about that whole era?
Well, I think one thing to do is to use it as a perspective to keep in mind that what the military is doing on the border now, I'm not saying I support it or don't support it, or whether it's a good idea. I'm not a decision maker in that. But that's not new. This is not a new story.
It's not unprecedented.
This is a very old story. And we may have a little different technology and all that, but the Army has always been committed to supporting the political aims of the administration. That's what the Army's job is, you know. And so I think the key thing to keep in mind is this is nothing new. This is an old part of Army history, and it'll probably continue into the future.
But this was a time when the border was kind of a hot zone. Pancho Villa come across and take American lives. A lot of chaos on the border with Mexico in civil war. But now we're not at war with Mexico. I mean, is it really that clear cut of a comparison?
In the broadest sense, it's not. But to the soldier on the river, it is. It's the same thing. You know what I mean? He's just trying to do his duty, and he's in a... I grew up on the Rio Grande. I grew up in Del Rio, so I understand that river up and down it. But to that soldier out there away from home, whether he's a National Guardsman, which they are right now, for him, that's his mission. He's on the Rio Grande. You could take his photograph in the right light and wouldn't know that that wasn't from 1910. Or 1898, he sees that border, he sees that river as a symbol of this is the United States. I'm standing here, I'm going to protect the United States.
Thomas T. Ty Smith is a military historian. He was a professor of military history at the United States Military Academy at West Point. He has published 8 books on the U.S. Army. His latest book is The Old Army in the Big Bend of Texas, The Last Cavalry Frontier, 1911 to 1921. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also write directly on our show page or on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can listen to past Texas Matters episodes. And you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.